Welcome to Conversations with David Lewis. Today, the United States of Jihad. My guest is Peter Bergen, CNN's terrorism analyst, and at the New America Foundation. His new book is United States of Jihad, Investigating America's Homegrown Terrorists. Peter, thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for having me back.
Indeed. I should say for the record, folks, that Peter and I have worked together at both ABC News and CNN and have been friends for, more than
30 years.
30 years. Peter, we're old. let me start before we get into the new book. 1997, you were the first person to interview Osama bin Laden. You had gone to Afghanistan as a very young man, right out of college or maybe even in college. You know, looking back on almost 20 years now of covering bin Laden and what has grown out of him and his movement, what stands out for you the most in terms of this journey that you personally have been on?
Well, the fact that we're having this conversation at all for the decade and a half after 9/11, I think, is sort of surprising. The fact that I thought with the death of bin Laden, and in fact, it was the first television interview that I produced. It was he had done previous print interviews, but with the death of bin Laden and the rise of the Arab Spring, in which Al Qaeda and its ideas played no part, I thought that the sort of jihadi terrorism movement would be, largely over, not gone, but, sort of more or less irrelevant. But of course, the Arab Spring turned into the Arab Winter and gave space, unfortunately, for both ISIS and other jihadi groups. While it's not a serious, really big problem for the United States, it's certainly a big problem for the Middle East, and to some degree, it's a big problem for Europe, as we saw in Paris with the attack that killed 130 people in November.
Indeed. I mean, it's funny. I was watching the Fox News debate last night, and it seems like there's a raging anger here that has never existed before. Is there a parallel to the raging anger unleashed by the Arab Spring winter
in the Middle East?
Yeah, I mean, are we living in an age of anger?
Yeah. Well, I've certainly seen some reporting suggesting that, if you look at the rise of the far right nationalist, quasi-fascist parties in Europe, I think you're seeing something that looks a little bit like, Trump analogs. The Hungarian prime minister actually built a wall, didn't talk about it. The French far-right party has done reasonably well. There's a British far-right party, and Angela Merkel is in deep trouble politically because of her decision to take on a lot of refugees. So, certainly we're seeing a lot of anger against established political parties, and not just in the United States, but elsewhere.
Indeed. So, although you didn't predict it, we do live in this age now where all of these other forms of jihad, ISIS being the most obvious, are growing. And your new book is about the United States of jihad. And you spent a couple of years really looking deep into this and doing some very deep research. What did you find?
Well, my team and myself built a database of 300-plus cases of jihadi basically jihadi terrorism cases in the United States since 9/11. And we found, and then the cases range from the trivial to the serious. We found that the average age of the people involved was 29. A third of them were married, a third have kids, average income, average education, similar to other Americans. And this was before the San Bernardino attack, where the perpetrators were 27 and 28. They were married, they had a kid. He had a very solid middle-class job working for the government. He was really living the American dream. So then that takes you to the question of, why would somebody go out and kill people that have nothing to do with making American foreign policy in the service of some, ideology which is against American foreign policy? And particularly, why would an American citizen do it? And that's really the subject of my book, which is One of the takeaways from these 300-plus cases is that overwhelmingly these are American citizens residents. These are not, by and large, immigrants or refugees. Major Nidal Hassan was born in Virginia, the Fort Hood shooter. The San Bernardino husband in that shooting incident was born in Chicago. Carlos Bledsoe, who killed an American soldier at Little Rock, Arkansas, was born in Memphis, Tennessee. The Boston Marathon bombers, one was an American citizen, one was an American legal resident. So, you know, this is an American phenomenon. And in a way, that's part of the reason that that is the case is now it's pretty hard or quite hard for a foreign terrorist to come into the country, as 19 did on and who conducted the 9/11 attacks. That is a lot harder to do.
But their ideas come in.
Yes. I mean, that's the other interesting thing that is different from where we were, say, pre-9/11, certainly. I mean, you know, I talked to people in the FBI for the book, and, you know, they say in the old days you had to go to a radical mosque or you had to, you know, travel overseas to some kind of jihadi training camp. And, you know, essentially that's not necessary now because all the ideology, which used to be mostly in Arabic, is now, you know, widely available in English. ISIS has a very aggressive output in English, not only on, you know, sort of tweets, but also, you know, 100-page books about how to join them, all in English, very well-written, very clear English about how to join them, how to behave in the West if you're planning an attack, and all sorts of things that are, you know, helping to foment this thing.
I'm talking with Peter Bergen, CNN's terrorism analyst. His new book is The United States of Jihad. So there's in your research, you found a very distinct pattern of how people were radicalized. You know, you have these wonderful sort of prom photos of Zachary Chesser and the like, and some of these Omar Hamani, some of these folks who had these very normal American lives, but there was a distinct process whereby they became radicalized. Describe it.
You know, Zachary Chesser and Omar Hamami, one was born in Daphne, Alabama. The other one was born in Washington, D.C. area. Both of them very bright. Both of them essentially converted to Islam and took on a more and more fundamentalist flavor. They began isolating themselves from their families. I actually wrote a note to Larry Wright, who wrote the book on Scientology, Going Clear, and asked him to what extent this looked like cult-like behavior, and he said it seemed very similar. So there was the isolation from the families, there was hanging out only with people who share your views precisely, and then rather crucially, they also both got married to people who precisely shared their views. And so you're in a sort of, you know, kind of echo chamber of people who just agree with you. And then at a certain point, both of them decided to, you know, move from ultra-fundamentalism to essentially, you know, joining the jihad. One of them, Zachary Chesser, was in Virginia. He tried to join Al-Shabaab, the Somali terrorist group. He didn't succeed, but he sort of launched a virtual jihad on the internet. That was his jihad. And then Omar Hamami did join Shabaab in Somalia and spent 6 years fighting with them before he was killed by the terrorist group. So there's often some commonalities in the way that people radicalize. The New York Police Department released a report in 2007 kind of outlining some of this. It was controversial at the time because, you know, some of these behaviors are simply somebody becoming an ultra-fundamentalist. And of course, there are many ultra-fundamentalists, but very few people who are violent ultra-fundamentalists. And so, you know, the decision to make that jump is a very personal one. And, you know, one of the people I profile in the book is a guy called Bernie Culvehouse, who was Omar Hamami's best friend, who basically went down exactly the same path. But when it came to the moment to go to Somalia, he decided not to go because he had a wife and kid, and he didn't want to abandon them. For Omar Hamami, who also had a wife and kid, that wasn't enough to keep him from going down the path of joining a terrorist, jihadi terrorist group.
And then there are folks like Samir Khan and Anwar al-Awlaki who have been the great sort of proselytizers in the English language. Tell me about each of them.
Well, you know, it's ironic or that the internet is largely an American creation, and Samir Khan and Anwar al-Awlaki were very adept at essentially creating an English language jihadist movement on the web, and they are both American. Anwar al-Awlaki was born in New Mexico, spent a good chunk of his life in San Diego and also Northern Virginia. Samir Khan grew up in New York City and spent a good chunk of his life in Charlotte, North Carolina. And Samir Khan was working as an office, basically in a very boring office job in Charlotte at a call center. And then he traveled to Yemen. Suddenly he joined Al-Qaeda. He described it as an enthralling moment. And one of the motivations for some of the folks that I profile is simply, you know, that it's very exciting to belong to a violent jihadist group for a lot of people. And, you know, there's a sense of belonging, there's a sense of purpose, and there's a sense of fun. And I think Samir Khan seemed to, you know, have this motivation, in addition to objections to American foreign policy and the like. He set up an English language magazine called Inspire, which unfortunately has inspired terrorist attacks around the English-speaking world. The Boston Marathon bombers read it, and they used bomb recipes they found in the pages of Inspire magazine to help them build their bomb in the Boston attack. A woman in the UK almost fatally wounded a British member of parliament, having listened to hundreds of hours of Anwar al-Awlaki, who's the other person who was also involved in Inspire magazine. And even in death, they were both killed in a CIA drone strike in 2011 in Yemen. Even in death, Anwar al-Awlaki's ideas keep showing up in pretty much every English language terrorism case you'll find, whether it's in Canada or Australia or the UK or the United States. Anwar al-Awlaki's lectures, which are delivered in colloquial English, colloquial American English, have been very inspirational. And so both his lectures and the magazine, unfortunately, have helped to continue fuel interest in this subject in the English-speaking world.
He even wrote about you.
Well, he did, but he wrote about a lot of people.
Still, like, that can't have been terribly comfortable.
Well, you know, I mean, yeah, he was in Yemen at the time, and I live in D.C. So, you know, he actually, I mean, it's interesting. Anwar al-Awlaki took to task both Fareed Zakaria of CNN and also myself for sort of saying that al-Qaeda and groups like it seem to have played no role in the Arab Spring, and perhaps this is their death knell. And unfortunately, of course, it was a self-serving view. Anwar al-Awlaki said, you know, just you wait, you know, that you will see, you know, kind of jihadi movements coming out of this. And of course, unfortunately, he was right, whether in Libya or Syria or Iraq or Yemen, we've seen the collapse of governments produce up space for these groups. And you can almost make a political law that the weaker the Muslim state is, the more likely there is to be a strong presence of ISIS or groups like it. So in failed or failing states, we're seeing, you know, ISIS and groups like it doing fairly well.
I'm talking with Peter Bergen, CNN's terrorism analyst, producer of the first television interview with Osama bin Laden in 1997. You had a long correspondence with, if I remember correctly from the book, Zachary Chesser. Tell me about your correspondence with him and where he is now. He didn't get, well, one of these folks, Hamani, I think, live-tweeted his own death, but Chesser never made it over there.
Yeah, so Chesser... listeners may recall that there was a kerfuffle around South Park, the cartoon show, having a cartoon character of the Prophet Muhammad in their show. And Chesser essentially solicited fellow jihadists to go and, essentially take matters into their own hands against the creators of South Park. He published the address of one of their houses. He incited violence. And of course, you know, we live in a country with a First Amendment, and First Amendment, you can say pretty much anything. But the one thing you can't do is incite violence to a group of people who may will actually execute incitation. And so, Chesser is now, he's kind of gone through the federal prison. He's in, because of, I think, sort of disruptive behavior, he's now actually in Supermax in Florence, Colorado. And he wrote me this very long letter, which kind of explained, I think, importantly, that he's completely unrepentant. And he even suggested there was a cartoonist called Molly Norris in Seattle, Washington, who was advised by the FBI to go into hiding because she had organized and everybody paint a cartoon of Prophet Muhammad Day. And she went into hiding in 2010, has not been seen since, and, you know, 6 years later. And of course, with the attack on the Charlie Hebdo satirical magazine in Paris, the attack on the Garland, Texas cartoon event last year, it's clear that people who have the jihadist ideology may well act violently against people they perceive as insulting the prophet. So Zach Chesser, in this letter to me, said that, you know, Molly Norris probably, you know, the only way out of this for her probably is if she converts to Islam, which is kind of a strange kind of piece of advice. But so, you know, this is all by way of saying that Zachary Chesser was part of this wave of people on the internet using Twitter and really kind of extending the jihad into the English-speaking world.
Tomorrow, we'll continue my conversation with Peter Bergen about his new book, United States of Jihad, Investigating America's Homegrown Terrorists.